So I guess some of what I might be talking about is old hat for some of you, so you should, you should tell me to skip things that I'm that are familiar to you, but I'm going to be trying to develop a couple of ideas about how we've come to look at processing in the visual system, although I suspect that it affects all systems in the brain, and that is that the response properties of neurons in any particular area are very dynamic, and they are subject to a number of influences, both in terms of context, in terms of alteration by experience, and in terms of top-down influences. And by top-down influences, I mean attention and perceptual task. So the tuning of neurons really changes quite radically over long periods of time with experience, and over short periods of time from moment to moment as animals or as people perform different perceptual tasks. And so any kind of models, I think, that one creates of processing in the visual cortex should begin to try to take into account these influences. And to a degree, we can attribute some of these influences to specific connections in the brain, and I'll present some results regarding that. So I guess just to start, one of the core issues that that affects this whole discussion is the main functional element that one uses to describe properties in any sensory system, which is the receptive field. And the very definition of the receptive field is undergoing some change, but there's quite a bit of confusion surrounding that. The receptive field was originally defined by Sherrington, who was using the term to describe the withdrawal reflex in dogs, where the scratch withdrawal reflex, if you scratch a certain part of the limb, the animal reflexively withdraws it. And there is a certain part of the skin surface that you would induce that reaction. And he called that part of the skin surface the receptive field. And that's where the term first was coined. And then later, when people developed the capability to record the responses of individual neurons or individual nerve fibers, they were able to characterize the receptive field for that entity. And so Kapper-Hartlein was one of the first people in the visual system to describe the receptive field of retinal ganglion cells. And there, the idea was that it was the area within which a stimulus could elicit a response from the nerve fiber or cell. But there was a more nuanced definition of that Steve Kuffler came up with. And actually, I think since that time, people have tried to make a distinction between the classical and non-classical receptive field. But actually, in this classical definition of the receptive field, I think you'll find anything that subsumes all of the subsequent broader definitions that people have made attempted to make. And the idea being that there are regions of the sensory surface where a stimulus by itself can't elicit a discharge, but can greatly modulate the response of neurons. And yes, please.
So, if the last definition holds, then the whole retina would be the receptive field of any fiber, right?
In principle, yes, because of the mechanical.
The adaptation to the overall luminance.
Well, no, but there's a question about the spatial extent where that adaptation comes from, and so while it to you may seem like overall luminance, the area within which you can get that adaptation effect is equivalent when you include a smaller part of the visual field. There is, however, a piece of information that was gleaned by Jim McElwain, where he found that many years ago that very distant stimuli from the core of the receptive field could modulate the response of the cell. Now, I don't think he described this as operating over the entire retina, But this was certainly one of the first descriptions of so-called non-classical receptive field effects, where there, you know, you could put a spot of light someplace else, and you could influence the response of the fiber. So there really are long-distance effects that propagate over over quite a range of visual space. And in fact, when we talk about contextual influences studied in the cortex, one has to try to distinguish between those effects that may be mediated within the retina versus the lateral geniculate nucleus versus the cortex. But there are certain properties of contextual influences in the cortex that would not likely come from the retina. And then finally, Ubel and Weasel described that it was not just, you know, light within the receptive field, but there were very clear constraints of shape, orientation, movement that influenced whether the cell would respond. Now also, there's the temporal component of the receptive field, and I'll be getting into this somewhat more detail later, but just to sort of introduce the idea, one thing that Hubel and Weasel also did was to describe that one of the properties that characterizes receptive fields in the visual cortex, that of ocular dominance, the balance of input from the two eyes, was something that could be modified by visual experience only during the first few months of life. In cats it was a few months, in monkeys it might be a year or two, and in humans it's thought to be about 6 to 8 years. And I think the idea that there was a critical period to constrain the experience-dependent modification led to a tacit assumption that that must apply to all properties in primary sensory areas, so that the property should be fixed in adulthood. However, it's certainly clear that in order for you to be able to encode the information necessary to learn and recognize new objects throughout life, such as, you know, recognizing new faces, there had to be a measure of plasticity somewhere. But this was thought to be a specialized property of the temporal lobe, where it had been thought that the encoding of object recognition took place, and that the early processes would be fairly safe from modification. But now I think, and I'm sure that Mike has already sort of told you extensively about this, it's now known that in adult animals, a whole range of other properties are mutable throughout life, and they are in sort of interesting ways. And one argument that I want to develop is that this property of plasticity is essentially represents a continuum from the early periods of postnatal life, where you are encoding the geometric properties of the visual world, to adulthood, where you encode information about the specific kinds of forms that you are trained on throughout life. And this sort of alteration can occur even in the primary visual cortex. So you're familiar with this general idea of the early studies on visual processing, that as you go from the retina to the visual cortex, you go from neurons, say retinal ganglion cells and cells in the lateral geniculate nucleus that have this center surround receptive field structure that gives them a sensitivity for contrast in the visual environment. And then you get to the cortex, where they are selected not only for contrast but also for the local orientation of contours going through the receptive field. And this idea that the receptive field really represents just a tiny window on the visual scene, and that the analysis is fairly local in terms of contour, that is, you're just sort of identifying the orientation at each given position in space, sort of leads to the problem that how do you sort of integrate this local orientation information into more global contours and into global percepts of entire objects. And this was something that was addressed by David Marr when he was trying to, in his models early on, when he was trying to characterize the relationship between the responses about what he then understood from the work of Hubel and Weasel to the issue of object perception. Between the percept of entire objects and the perception of local attributes such as orientation and contrast, there is been identified a component of the visual process which has been dubbed intermediate level vision, and that refers to contour integration and surface segmentation. And so we'll give you some perceptual examples of that. Maybe I'll just skip over this for now. And there's actually been kind of a parallel development that started also quite early on back in the 1920s from the Gestalt psychologists that tried to point out that the way the visual system worked made certain kind of assumptions about the world, and that the contours that are salient have certain kinds of geometric properties. And they gave a lot of examples about this, but this sort of they pointed out that the global characteristics of contours and surfaces influenced your percept of even the simple attributes such as local contrast and orientation. And I'll give you a bunch of examples of that. And so it seemed that they were trying to argue that one can't think of this process as being simply a feed-forward one where you're assembling objects from the local elements, but that even the perceptual qualities of the local elements were influenced by the global properties of the whole. And the kinds of examples that he cited were such as these, where if you were trying to engage in a process of contour linkage, that is to decide what elements of the visual scene are connected to what. There are certain linkages that are natural, so that you will link contour A with contour C, and you won't link contour A with contour D. And so, in fact, if you think about it, this process of assembling scenes from the local elements, in principle, could be an almost impossible problem. There would be an infinite number of solutions, but the visual system tends to make certain fundamental assumptions which are related to the characteristics of the natural world, as I'll describe to you later. And so this kind of linkage is more natural in a sense than this one. This tendency for the visual system to make these kinds of linkages leads to the percept of illusory contours. So you see a boundary going from one corner of the triangle to the other, even though obviously there's no contrasting boundary here. And that is because the visual system is trying to link elements that, for example, have similar relative orientation, even if they may be distributed over quite large distances. And here is an example where you do a process of perceptual fill-in, so that you see a pink square, even though there is no difference in the color between the inside and the outside of the square. Now, there's been some more recent examples of the kinds of phenomena that the Gestalt psychologists had originally described, and this relates to the percept of contour saliency and this process of linking the elements of contours. So in this image, you have two contours, one of which is made out of line elements that have similar relative orientation as you go along the contour, and the other one where there is much more jumble in the relative orientation of the consecutive line elements. If you embed either of these contours in a complex background of randomly oriented and positioned line elements, this one pops out quite readily from the background, whereas this one you don't see. You can pick it up through a process of serial search, but it definitely doesn't pop out. And so there's something about the geometric characteristics of contours that endows them with this attribute of saliency. The Gestalt psychologist called it good continuation.
Yeah. When you try to gradually changing the angles and see if this whole part is really immediate.
No, it's actually, people have done the psychophysics of this, that's right. And so the There are a lot of parameters on which you can adjust that. We've actually been doing a lot of this lately. And so you can make psychrometric curves of this that where there is a steep, but
maybe just slowly change the angle.
That's right. It's just a matter of the percentage of times that you pick it up. It doesn't suddenly click. Although when it pops out, but it's just, yeah. But the way you measure it is in terms of percentage of times you recognize a contour present or absent. And there are a lot of other things that you can change. I didn't bring along the more recent data that we have, but you know, if you change the spacing between the contour elements, you also cause the pop out to disappear.
The slip strategy change from the parallel to the serial one.
Although again, it's just a matter of certainly when you see the pop out, it's a distinct event, but the number of instances where it pops out with a limited time presentation can vary somewhat gradually. Increase the time and or the reliability. And then the other process that we're interested in is something called surface segmentation. That is the ability to take the elements of one surface and assign them to the foreground, to the object, and separate that from the background. So in this example, the local characteristics are similar between the foreground, these dappled horses, and the background, the snowy field, but still you can do a pretty good job of linking and assembling these contours into the objects and segmenting from them from the background.
That was a bit of a cheat, because I suspect that, well, I certainly started with the legs and worked up, and the legs are pretty.
Yeah, I suspect that you wouldn't need that, though. I mean, it may make it easier, but I'm sure you would be able to do it even without that. There's other examples of how the percept of the local features is dependent on the rather more global surface representations and 3D surface representations, and Ted Adelson has made a number of good examples of this. So here, if you think sort of a basic kind of attribute like darkness or lightness, in this particular example, you have two gray squares that look fairly similar in their grayness or brightness, whereas these two squares look very different. Yeah, all four of them are all the same brightness, but it's because of this how you sort of perceive the global shape and the folding of this surface that influences how you see the local attribute of brightness. And it's because the visual system makes certain assumptions about the characteristics of the natural world. Objects that are sort of exposed to the heavens are supposed to be brighter than ones that are obscured, because light sources generally come from above. So if they have two surfaces that are the same brightness, the lower one will appear to be brighter. So I think these sorts of processes had originally been assumed to be developing progressively as you went along the visual pathway from the occipital lobe into the temporal lobes. And as you know, there are quite a number of different visual cortical areas, 30 or more, many of which are involved in this so-called object pathway or form pathway. And I think the expectation had been that there was a progressive complexification of functional properties as you went from the earlier visual cortical areas, the primary visual cortex, on into the temporal lobe. But there undoubtedly is a measure of that happening. But what we are finding is that even back in the primary visual cortex, cells show selectivity for more complex stimulus configurations than people had originally believed. And part of this may be coming from a pattern of connectivity in the visual cortex that we discovered some years ago, whereby, such as with this cell, neurons send axons that extend for considerable distances parallel to the cortical surface. We call these long-range horizontal connections. Now, given that the visual cortex is retinotopically mapped, what that means is that, say, a cell over here is integrating information over an area of cortex representing an area of visual space that is much larger than their receptive field. Now, that's how we sort of, that was the sort of shorthand that we used to describe this phenomenon early on. But of course, when you say something is larger than the receptive field, it really depends on how you define the receptive field. And I'll try to give you somewhat more of a nuanced definition of the receptive field. There's nothing magical here. I mean, if you use the receptive field in its most general sense, these connections do match the extent of the receptive field. But in order to see the receptive field in its fullest extent, you have to use more complex visual stimuli, and where you find that there are these extended modulatory regions that extend for a considerable distance from the receptive field core. But one can characterize the extent of these connections visuotopically, and I'll show you how we do that, and compare it to the extent of the perceptual interactions one can measure psychophysically, and the contextual interactions one can measure physiologically by recording from neurons in the superficial layers of the visual cortex. So we originally described these connections by this method, which involves intracellular recording and dye injection. And there you reveal this plexus of axonal connections. There's two important features of these connections that you have to appreciate. One is, first of all, their extent, to refer to, and the second is that the connections are distinctly clustered in their distribution, with a periodicity of something like a millimeter or so.
I have questions about
it. Yeah.
Do we see all connections, or is it a small fraction?
You are seeing all of the collaterals of this cell.
What about the ones that are out of the slide?
This is a reconstruction over serial sections. Yeah.
Okay. And another thing, can you say anything about the physiological properties of these connections?
The what? The
physiological properties, like long range versus local. Are they different?
I'll be getting into that, but I suspect that the properties that are mediated by these connections are sort of a continuum. They sort of originate, they start short range and they go long range. There's not a sort of division between one set of properties that are gotten from these local connections within the dendritic field and the longer range connections. But I think what a point that is sort of more critical is to distinguish the properties that are mediated by these horizontal connections and ones that are mediated by the vertical connections. So let's say a cell sitting over here is receiving a strong input from layer 4C. So the dominant visual pathway, so to say, is from the thalamus to, from the lateral nucleus to layer 4C, then from layer 4C to layer 3B. That's the parvocellular pathway. There's also a magnocellular pathway. But at any rate, that's the sort of major sequence. Those connections tend to be somewhat more local, whereas the pyramidal cells and spiny stellate cells and other layers can form these long-range horizontal connections, so that they're more extended.
But this is sort of just a geometrical difference, but I was wondering if you can say, for example, that local connections are stronger than long range, how many do you think this could be different?
Right. Well,
is it known?
It's actually known to a degree. Certainly, these the long range, you know, whether a given synapse is strong or weak, I think these are modifiable. And so you can have a distant strong connection or a closer in weak connection. But in terms of the populations, the number of boutons that are formed locally is greater than the ones that are more distant. You see the number of axon collaterals that tail off the farther away you get. And so one might expect that the farther away you get from the receptor field core, the weaker the contextual interactions will be. But that's sort of a fairly limited point of view. And in fact, even the very distant ones can be strong depending on the other inputs that the cells are receiving. And I'll show you an example of that.
General question. You started with these Gestalt properties, and now you switched immediately to this long-range connections in cortex, but how about all the feedback from IR? How do you cut them?
That's going to be one of the themes that I'm going to try to develop, but the sort of short answer is that it's been a matter of some considerable debate, and we can sort of talk about some of the other evidence that people have come up with to distinguish whether these contextual interactions come from intrinsic connections, such as these long-range horizontal connections, or if they come via feedback. And as yet, there is no definitive answer that really resolves this, although there's some evidence that points at least to some role for these horizontal connections in these long-range influences. I don't think people really fully appreciate the role of these feedback connections, although there's a lot that has to be done in addition to mediating contextual influences, and that has to do with the kinds of top-down, more cognitive influences of spatial attention and task. And I would imagine that the feedback connections must at least be playing a role in that, to whatever extent they may be playing a role in the contextual interactions.
That's right.
So the contextual interactions may be mediated by the pattern of convergence from feedback, or it may be done in a higher area, and then the information just fed back. So yeah, these are all very distinct possibilities. What one can ask if there's anything in the geometry of these connections that allows you to perhaps tease apart these possibilities. One thing that, just to anticipate things that I'll be suggesting by the end, is that there is an interaction between the horizontal connections and the feedback connections. So actually, what is manifest at any given time is a product of local and feedback interactions, and it may be in fact somewhat false to try to make a distinct assignment of an influence from one area, one source, or another. And it makes it very difficult to try to figure out the role of any of these connections. That's why I think that some computational models may be very, very useful in the future. Because any sort of experiment that you may do may be subject to vagaries of interpretation. So we think that the horizontal connections are in turn gated by feedback connections. So even if the algorithm or the information is present in the horizontal connections, if you inactivate the source of the feedback connections, you may be influencing the horizontal connections, and therefore any property that is altered by an activation of feedback, you might say, well, that's due to the fact that the information came from the feedback, but that's not necessarily the case. I just want to put in that
note of quote.
Yes. So we were interested in trying to come up, and there are a lot of different ways of trying to get at these questions. We were trying to come up with a kind of quantitative anatomy that would enable us to sort of see at least the plausibility of the involvement of either feedback or horizontal connections in mediating the contextual influences. And so the various elements you'll be getting from different points in the talk. But one question is about whether there's anything in the extent or specificity of either of these classes of connections that would tend to suggest their role in one process or another. But in order to do this, we were kind of dissatisfied with the available anatomical techniques, because you want something that really gives you something that it gives you a very complete pattern of labeling, and one that gives you consistent results from experiment to experiment and from connection to connection. And a lot of these anatomical techniques you have to be very careful of, particularly retrograde tracing techniques, which are subject to thresholding and don't give you a very complete picture. Certainly intracellular injections gives you a fairly complete picture, but that doesn't give you a picture over a population, and it's impractical to inject the number of cells you need to inject in order to see what the pattern is over the population. So we developed a technique that gives you intracellular injection level quality fills and allows you to do it for larger number of cells, and you can sort of define as you like the number of cells that you want to label. And that involves using a viral vector to inject a gene into cells that encodes for the green fluorescent protein. So the cells incorporate the gene and then transcribe and translate that and essentially fill themselves up with this dye. And as you see from this image, where the injection was done off at the corner here, you get a very rich pattern of labeling where you can see the individual axons, and this you can reconstruct with a confocal microscope over serial sections. It's a rather painstaking process still, but it certainly gives us a more complete picture of the labeling.
Where does it actually end up in the cell membrane, in the cytoplasm?
In the cytoplasm. But it has a lot of nice features. Since it has to get to the nucleus in order for this process to take place, you don't label fibers of passage. You know the cells that are the source of the pattern of projections, and so you don't have to be concerned about these penumbras of labeling that you see with things like HRP. You identify precisely the area of cells that are labeling and giving rise to these projections. Yes, as it happens, although it is funny that there are vagaries with this technique, and I think, you know, depending on the vector itself and the promoter, you can be more selective if you want about the cell population that is labeled, but we were just interested in labeling all the neurons, and this seems to be reasonably unselective for our purposes. There are other vectors that tend to only target glial cells, and that doesn't help. This technology is actually moving forward quite rapidly, and people are developing vectors that allow labeling for longer periods of time, ones that where you can selectively label certain subpopulations of neurons. So it's very promising.
So I didn't quite understand what you said about not labeling fibers of passage. So this is done in vivo, right?
Yes, the injection is done in vivo.
So why doesn't genetic material get transported back to the nucleus?
It doesn't. If it did, you'd see it. So I mean, it's empirical observation. So you see the cell that is giving rise to these projections, and you only see cells labeled that are at the injection site.
I see. So only cells for cell bodies are within certain distance of the injection site.
That's right.
Yes. Does the virus keep reproducing?
No, it's a non-replicative form of the virus. So you're dependent on the number of transcripts you can get from the gene that is introduced.
Vanessa, do you label your distribution of labeling among cell types?
That hasn't really been looked at terribly carefully, but we do see that we get, you know, quite a range of cell types. Whether that exactly matches the the proportion of these cell types in the tissue isn't really known. But they're, you know, at least, I mean, the indication of what we have so far is that you are labeling neurons at least as frequently as glia. I mean, the concern is that certain vectors only go towards glia, and then you can't really use it for this sort of analysis. So this gives you this kind of clustering pattern of these axons, as well as shows these axons over quite some distance. And if you record the receptive field diameters and positions in the region of this the injection and the projection area, you can then determine precisely over what visuotopic extent these connections go. And so in this particular animal, the injection was made over here, and this was the most distant axon collateral. These are the receptive fields in this region. And here, the receptive field is measured by what is known as the minimum response field technique. That is, you take a line segment and you place it in different positions along the orientation axis or along the orthogonal axis, and you get a profile of the receptive field, and this is the sort of full bandwidth of the receptive field. So, in general, in the superficial layers of the monkey's visual cortex, receptive fields are under a half a degree in diameter, yet the area over which these connections extend tends to go more like 4 degrees, 3 or 4 degrees. And so we've been quantifying this over a number of injections. This distance here from the center to the edge can go up to say about 2 degrees, and one can compare that pattern of this was a, sort of an earlier reconstruction. I wasn't able to bring one of the more recent ones, but this is the pattern of intrinsic horizontal connections, where this is the center of the injection site, and this is the pattern of feedback connections from area V2. Where the green spot represents the point in, that corresponds visuotopically to the injection site in V2. So this is the projection to V1, and this is the visuotopic corresponding point to within V1 to the injection site in V2. So there are a couple of differences you can see when you compare the horizontal connections and the feedback projections. One is that that the density is at every point about an order of magnitude lower for feedback than for the horizontal connections. And also you might see the suggestion that, and I'll show you some better evidence for this, that the horizontal connections are clustered, whereas the feedback connections tend to, while they're not really uniform, they don't show this distinct clustering pattern.
How did you do this? By injecting in V2?
That's right.
I mean, if feedback is not as topographic, then it might come from a much wider area than you label. So that if you label the full area, you'd see that for feedback.
No, I mean, this is the degree of topographic specificity is shown by this. So you can express it either in terms of the breadth of the projection from a point in V2 to an area in V1, or the projection from an area of V2 to a point in V1. Mm-hmm. But the same thing applies for the horizontal connections, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay, but in terms of the actual density at a given point.
I mean, I think it applies equally, and that, you know, these are sort of two sides of the same coin, and they're two ways of measuring it. You could use a retrograde label, although they're not very good, inject it into V1 to see the area of V2 that converges into that point in V1. But I think you get the same sort of measure when you make a point injection in V2 and look at the projection back to V1.
Integrate.
Yeah.
What is, presumably those feedback projections come through certain layers. So what is the layer specifically?
They actually go to all layers, but it's densest to the upper part of the superficial layers. One thing that the virus shows is that it does extend a lot more than people had shown before. It sort of earlier anatomical anatomical techniques seem to suggest that they sort of were restricted to layer one, but it's not that restricted. It goes all through the superficial layers most densely, but then it even goes.
But this density is taken integrated.
Yes, that's right. So these are reconstructed over the same number of sections, and this is actually kind of earlier data, but we've reconstructed over a larger depth of cortex.
But the interesting message here is that it's even more local than the local.
Well, that's right. At least now, we should also take into account that there are feedback projections from other cortical areas, but you can get feedback projections from area IT, from the temporal lobe, but they're very sparse. Those are thought to be somewhat more widespread, but we haven't yet characterized them with this technique. So the densest feedback to V1 is from V2, and that's as dense as the feedback gets. And the area, the extent visuotopically, I would say is probably equivalent, so that even if the feedback projections don't go as far as the intrinsic horizontal connections, the cells of origin have somewhat larger receptive fields than the cells in V1. So when you take everything into account, in terms of visuotopic extent, they're probably more or less the same.
Charles, just to get a further sense of the scale, even though it's coming into a different layer, if you look at that thalamic afferents, where does their density lie numerically?
First of all, the thalamic afferents are limited to less than 2 millimeters in extent. The horizontal connections go for 6 to 8 millimeters.
For these pictures, you get a sense of coverage by looking at a given area. Right, and sort of your numbers, right? You can extend for how many millimeters of axon.
Right.
We just look at this region of maximum coverage. So this is, you know, order 10^3 inverse millimeters square.
Right.
So if I look even within this dense area, layer 4.
Yeah. So the question then you want to ask is, for the layer 4 cells that immediately underlie that site, what is the density?
Right. Is that also in order 1,000, or is that higher?
I don't know. I don't, and it is not known. I mean, because one has to use the same technique, I think, now to make that comparison. I mean, we've in the past injected neurons in layer 4 and looking at their projection upwards. If I had to guess, I would say it would probably be a similar order.
Is there a constancy across the area 17 representation in terms of millimeters as there is with the points
group? Yeah, that's something that has come up quite a bit. Now that I think we have this technique, we can address it. But so far, all of our experiments have, and in fact, I mean, this is a good issue that Mike raises. And when I make these comparisons between the extent of horizontal connections in visuotopic terms or the extent of influences measured psychophysically or physiologically, they're all done at the same eccentricity, at roughly 3 degrees eccentricity. And so we've actually designed our experiments so we could make the same, make comparable measurements. But it's a reasonable question as to whether the extent of these connections is constant in cortical terms. Is it always 6 to 8 millimeters wherever you go within V1, or does it change? And that, I mean, I suspect that it's the same, but it's more kind of anecdotal evidence, and that hasn't really been looked at systematically.
Well, just a quick thing. So the reason there is a cutoff in the intrinsic projections is because the density is too high, you can't count there anymore.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Obviously you can fiddle with the injections to try to keep fewer cells labeled, but it gets so dense, and it really kind of scales up quite rapidly. Mm-hmm. So that's another point of comparison that one can make, and that we have made, that the feedback projections tend to be sort of more uniform across the field. I mean, they do drop off, but there's kind of a large plateau in the middle, whereas the intrinsic connections have this steep gradient.
And how wide is typically the area in which the cells take up the virus?
That's also something that we can adjust, and we try to keep the injection site to under a couple of hundred microns in diameter.
So So this steep drop off, 2 millimeters, is very normal. Is this just usual? It's always happening?
No. Well, so what you're seeing is a reflection of the clustering of these horizontal connections. So it goes down and then up and then down.
Okay, I understand. But I was just asking for is there something like a range of short range interactions? Are there two distributions superimposed or? This looks like you have a 2 millimeters, you have a sharp drop off, and then you have a sharp drop off.
Right. Well, certainly, you don't between 0 and 1. Everything is labeled. So you don't have any valleys within there. What sort of fit would best model these connections? I think is open for discussion. But we just tend to think of this as kind of a exponential drop off with clusters superimposed, but you may be able, if you had the data, you might be able to come up with a better description. So one way that you can use to characterize the tendency for clustering of these connections is to do an autocorrelation. And so this is the autocorrelation function for the intrinsic connections, and this is for the feedback. And so for the intrinsic connections, you can see that there's the distinct peak at the center, which is obviously the correlation with itself. So what you do is you take the image and you sort of shift it in different positions in X and Y, and you look at the correlation in density at every point. And then there's a valley and then a peak again. So this shows the periodicity of the horizontal connections. And with the feedback connections, there is some sort of texture to it and some periodicity. But now when we compare the feedback projections to the optically imaged maps of orientation columns in the visual cortex, we find that there is essentially a flat relationship. So there isn't an orientation specificity in the feedback projections. Whereas it's long been known, first from these kinds of experiments, and then I'll show you a couple of examples, that the horizontal connections, this clustering that you see, mediates connections between columns of the same specificity. So you have this like-to-like principle of connectivity, so the vertical orientations connect with vertical orientation columns, horizontal with horizontal. There's a certain bandwidth to that.
So at one time I remember that this was quite controversial. Maybe not in your hands.
Not in my view, but actually there was a report way back when this sort of work was started that there was from Matsubara and Sanader, there was one example that they thought it went too perpendicular. That was not a reliable result. That was done in V2, but it was also not done properly. It was like an injection that covered about a millimeter of cortex, which you can't use to make this sort of study. And I think pretty much everybody, there's quite a number of studies now where people have looked at this, and it all seems to bear out the same result. There might be some discussion about the quantitative details, that is, what is the bandwidth of the orientation specificity? It's always centered like-to-like, but how broad is it? Is it different locally versus long range? And there's certainly much more dispersion in the orientation specificity within this 1 millimeter range, and as you go farther out, it becomes much more specific in this like-to-like pattern. Yeah. That's right.
So you've got peak and you can go by 2 valleys?
Yeah.
How should I read the presence of that peak with those 2 valleys? I mean, is the peak before and the valleys are that the two are inhibiting each other mutually, or what?
I think the way we've used the cross-correlation analysis is just to see between what classes of cells do you get interactions, that is, neural interactions, versus ones which are firing independently. It's very treacherous to try to read too much into the shape and the distribution of the cross-correlation function for a number of reasons. But you see that these generally overlap with the zero point to some extent. What happens is that the anatomy is not a purely unidirectional connection. So, and it's also kind of a mass action. So you have many cells in one column connecting to many cells in another column. So what these peaks are representing is bidirectional interactions as well as common input interactions. So the two cells you're recording from are in turn receiving input from lots of other cells. And then the valleys, you also have to be careful that, you know, there's a certain refractory period in firing, and that will contribute to a valley on either side of the peaks. But there's also, and I want to get to this in a little bit later, these connections are, so far that you've just seen the pattern of connections. We've done serial EM reconstructions where we can identify the targets of the connections, and I'll get into that later. So they can mediate both excitation and inhibition, although inhibition is sort of known to be not very, the cross-correlation technique is not very sensitive to looking at monosynaptic or disynaptic inhibition. So that's why I wouldn't try to get too involved in interpreting the shape of these peaks in detail, but there is a certain pattern that comes out when you look over a population. Sure. I'm never going to leave this slide.
The correlation function for the intrinsic is not only the peak after a millimeter, but it's also the direction.
Yeah.
Is this a typical case?
It's not always the case, no. And in fact, as we completed the reconstruction, now we have a fuller reconstruction on which to base the autocorrelation function. It isn't completely circularly symmetrical. I have to give you that, but it's not quite so extreme.
But there may be something. Spontaneous?
No, it's you have to drive the cells because there's very little spontaneous activity, but. No, there's a lot of ways you can correct for that, and so you do this the shift correction, as well as we've gone into this in some detail.
The point. I mean, the shift correction is just subtracting up the average of the correlation. I think you should say if you drive it hard, maybe it'll stop the fire in bursts as it the fire regularly. You might change the nature of the spiking of the cell.
Well, that may be, but I don't think you'll change the picture about whether you get a correlation or not. Yeah, that's right. But you know, there are certainly lots of concerns with the correlation. That the peaks that are sort of relatively narrow, like these, are more meaningful than the broad peaks that a lot of people have reported, and there's a lot of problems with the correlation technique because there are these constitutive changes in excitability that nobody really knows the origin of, and that would give you a correlation peak, but they tend to be sort of broad relative to the period of the stimulus.
Yeah, I'd like to take another aspect of previous slide. It's still fairly radially symmetric compared to
yes.
So I would like to know how you compare it. And then there has been this recent paper from the monkey cortex that also claims there is axial selectivity, and I thought it would be interesting to try
and
carry it.
Yeah, that's right. There is this curiosity that there seems to be a species difference between the degree of anisotropy you see in these connections. Even in the macaque monkey where these experiments are done, there may be a measure of anisotropy, but it's by no means anything like what David Fitzpatrick reports. And I believe David's result. But I think there is there's something else that's interesting in the difference between the species in terms of the tuning characteristics of the cells. So I should probably show something about the geometry of these contextual interactions before we get back to that point. And I hope you remind me again. But when I show the two-dimensional receptive field maps of contextual interactions, maybe we can return to the point of about the anisotropy. But I mean, this is old stuff. I'm sort of still, you know, it's I'm still hoping to get to the newer work. But the point here, it was just that when you do the cross-correlation between pairs of cells at variant separation within the cortex, you see this waxing and waning of the strength of correlation. So there is this periodicity that matches the periodicity of the horizontal connections. And even at some distance, like here, where the cells have fairly widely separated receptive fields, you get this correlation. And so, another important feature of this is that the points where you see correlation is when the cells have matching receptive field orientation. And that goes along, this is kind of also an early experiment. No, I mean you in that experiment you can't differentiate because you know you're only moving out in what, along one axis. You can't say whether. Yeah, but we also see correlations with this arrangement. It's not you don't only get it that way.
Okay.
I mean, in that one, you only see one because of the receptive fields are moving out in that direction.
No, just
right.
So there's a case where they are parallel.
So these here they're aligned, and here they're aligned. But that's just because we were looking at horizontally oriented cells, and that axis in the cortical map, you're moving out along the horizontal meridian.
Well, for the very top one,
the
orientation
top one.
Of their own
line. Yeah. Okay. So
they're
that's
very close.
The
earlier statement that when they're that close, even the route of orientation.
Right. Now this was done in the cat.
Is this the bottom line of cat's meow, you might say? I mean, there's 3 degrees of freedom. I mean, yes, the relative orientation,
right.
The alignment, right?
Right.
There's the distance, and it bears on much other work. Well, I call this work on synchrony.
Right.
Been a more systematic study, or if this was Banchow's thesis.
That's right.
Or is this sort of the definitive work?
I don't think anybody else has tried to really kind of quantify the strength of correlation across, you know, the tangentially across the cortical surface since then. Although a lot of the work from Singer's lab and people associated with him were using this technique when they subsequently said, well, I don't know if we should get into a discussion of synchrony here, but they were. They made the suggestion that it is the synchrony itself, the relative timing of signals, that is the important measure to perform linkage as opposed to response rate, and they were sort of doing similar sorts of things in cross correlation. So we did cross correlations. We said cells of similar orientation connected. They did the same thing and said, well, they're synchronized, and it was synchrony that was an important signal for linkage. So this is our early anatomical experiment to show the same thing, where this now later in the horizontal connections with a retrograde tracer, fluorescently labeled beads, latex microspheres. And you get clusters of labeled cells labeled retrogradely from the injection site, which is at the black spot. And we labeled the orientation columns with the 2-deoxyglucose technique, which now is sort of passé. And this experiment has subsequently been done with optical imaging. You get the same result, which is that the columns that are labeled are the ones that have the same orientation specificity as the injection site. And another way you can look at this is work that was done by Anuruddha Das on using the optical imaging technique to look at the point spread of the distribution of activation. If you look at the distribution of activation within the cortex from a point of light, or in practice we don't use a point of light, we use a short oriented line segment, which is the most effective stimulus. So you... Have people talked about optical imaging?
Yeah, we talked about it.
No more darkness. Okay, so so you know what that technique is. So you can use that technique to look at the distribution of orientation columns as projected onto the cortical surface if you use a global stimulus like this. And so this is a false color image of the columns of different orientation specificity, with blue representing horizontal, yellow vertical, and red and green the right and left obliques. But if you use a more restricted stimulus, you can actually get some additional information from this. So what you can do is to see the area of activation within the cortex by when you use this more restricted stimulus and look at the orientation specificity of it. And what you see, this is a real signal here, from here to here is about, this experiment was about 4 millimeters. And so the area that you measure here represents an area of visual space. So if you combine the optical imaging with the electrophysiological recordings and receptive field mapping, these are the receptive fields of the cells in and around this point spread area, around the optical point spread. And so the area of activation, when compared to the size of the stimulus that was used, or the diameter of receptive fields in this region, is roughly an order of magnitude larger than the diameter of the receptive fields. And but if you do a denser set of electrode penetrations, you find the area of spiking activity is only about 0.5 millimeter in diameter. And so what we think this represents is subthreshold activation from a core of spiking cells that sends axons distributed over by the horizontal connections. And one knows that subthreshold postsynaptic activity contributes to this intrinsic signal, as does spiking activity. And so what you're seeing is a reflection of the of this lateral extent. A moving bar.
Moving bar and restricted to some.
It's about 0.25 degree. Yes.
Is this an average?
No, that's a two condition subtraction. So
yeah,
you many
stimulus
presentations. Yes, for many stimulus presentations. That's right.
And you subtract from what?
Vertical from horizontal, but over the full stimulus set consists of maybe 16 orientations, and then then you sort of assign a strength of signal at each pixel for each orientation, and you get a resultant. So you do this
so
kind of thing.
It's not possible to say that it's dark or white. Dark
is more.
The dark dots are like five big dots. Which are elicited by the horizontal bar versus the vertical bar.
That's right.
And the second question I have is, do the colors actually match?
Yes. So if you subtract this one from that one, it's all blue. That is all zero. So that's another argument for why these connections are like to like. Because you get the...
It seems like you change the color of color.
No.
There's something very red there, which is very green there.
Well, let's see if I can open this one. I have to sort of close the presentation to find the slide. There's a lot of artifact. So this is actually bone here. You can see blood vessels coming here. And so you have to know where your signal is coming from to know whether it's real or not. So another thing that you have to be aware of are certain aspects of what the connectivity and synaptic physiology of these horizontal connections is, and that is that although the longest range connections are formed by pyramidal neurons, which are excitatory in their postsynaptic effect, they're all glutamatergic, the postsynaptic targets are in roughly a 4-to-1 ratio other pyramidal cells and inhibitory interneurons. So the fact that that the excitatory connections are dominant might lead you to expect that these horizontal connections should be predominantly facilitatory. However, that's not a very good assumption, because the synaptic effect of the horizontal connections is kind of state dependent. And as you see here, as you change the level of recruitment of these horizontal connections, these are recordings, intracellular recordings, done in cortical slices by Judith Hirsch. And what she did was to record from a neuron, say the yellow one, and then have a stimulating electrode a couple of millimeters away to activate the horizontally evoked synaptic potentials. So with weak stimulation, you get pure excitation, and as you increase the strength of the stimulus, this excitation is then carved by a strong disynaptic inhibition. In some instances, you'll see more inhibition. In some instances, at a given length of stimulation, you'll see more excitation. And I'll suggest to you where you might be seeing more of one and another in terms of the spatial relationships of the source of stimulation.
So the left and the right column are recordings from different.
Yes, that's right. And. And you can see that the level of activation can be very strong, but also, if you don't have this slide up, if you depolarize the neuron by current injection, even though you're bringing the neuron closer to the reversal potential for excitation, you actually get much larger excitatory synaptic potentials. And that is because you're activating voltage-dependent sodium conductances. So this sort of suggests that while the influence of a horizontal connection might ordinarily be weak when it's activated by itself, it can be much stronger when you simultaneously activate another input to the cell. And that's reflected in the kind of facilitation that we see. If you include a stimulus within the receptive field and a stimulus outside the receptive field, you get a very strong modulation by the stimulus outside the receptive field, even though by itself it doesn't activate, it's just those recording sites near the center of this point spread. So given that these horizontal connections have this sort of distribution, roughly 2 degrees from the center to the edge, they have this like-to-like orientation specificity, one can then ask whether, to what extent, that coincides with the functional properties of neurons in the visual cortex, and also with these perceptual phenomena of contour saliency, or another one, which I'll start with, which is one called brightness induction. So to look at how stimuli may interact in visual space, what we did was to start with kind of a pairwise interaction. These are experiments that were done by Mitesh Kapadia and in collaboration with Gerald Westheimer. First, psychophysical experiments represented on the top, and then physiological experiments on the bottom. And in the psychophysical experiments, the subject fixates at a point of light here, and then attends to the periphery at a target line, and you're supposed to say whether this line is present or not in multiple stimulus presentations, both when it's presented in isolation and when it's presented in conjunction with a flanking line. And at a certain level of contrast, when the line is presented alone, you can reliably see it, or see it 50% or 75% of the time, whatever your criterion is. But when you put this flanking line in a collinear position nearby, you can see that target line at 40% lower contrast. And so there is this induction effect, so that the appearance of lines depends on what is surrounding them. And you get a similar kind of facilitation when you record from receptive fields. So here, if you put a line within the receptive field, you get a certain response. You put a line by itself outside the receptive field, by definition, you get no response. But when you put the two together, the response can be doubled or as much as tripled when you relative to the response to the line within the receptive field itself. So even though this line isn't doing anything by itself, it can triple the response of the cell compared to the line within the receptive field.
So the lines in high contrast?
These experiments were done at relatively low contrast. But
talk about electrophysiology.
Yes.
It's
sort of intermediate, but it's the lower.
A very good threshold for psychophysics.
What threshold is in humans? Right?
Yeah. Well, this actually also works. This is a detection experiment. We've done the same experiment subsequently in a matching experiment where we use super threshold stimuli, and you get a similar kind of effect.
Is it humans or monkeys?
This is humans.
Okay.
And this is monkeys. Yeah.
So,
that's right.
So in A, red has a low contrast, and yellow has a high contrast.
No, they were the same contrast, but we've done this experiment many different ways. So you can sort of have high here and low here, you know, or vice versa. Well, the degree of facilitation is dependent on contrast, but it's also dependent, and what we think is sort of more important, it's also dependent on what is in the vicinity. So if you just do these pairwise experiments, you get one kind of phenomenon, but if you have a much more complex background, you get another.
And you never get inhibition?
I don't think we ever saw inhibition.
Even that orthogonal
inhibition? We haven't done that. No.
It's just means everything gets better. At no cost.
No, but one thing that is very important is it's dependent on the geometry. So you get very similar geometry of these perceptual effects and the physiological effects. This is just the example of the physiology. So that as you pull the lines away in space, the facilitation goes away, and also it's very critically dependent on alignment. So if you just make a small shift in the alignment of line inside and outside the receptive field, you can go from facilitation to inhibition, and it's dependent on the angle between the two lines. So you get the strongest effect when they have the same orientation, and it goes away as you change the relative orientation.
How does the middle one relate
to the Fermi theory? It's closely related. So, we haven't actually done the ROC analysis, but the slope of this is about what you'd expect from vernier acuity. So the point that we want to make here is that we have now quantified at matched eccentricities the extent of this interaction, and this goes for about 2 degrees, as does the horizontal connections, as does the brightness induction effect, and so they all match very, very closely.
So this little graph, it's zero for everything.
That's right. Yeah, you know, you get a fair amount of diversity in neurons. So over the population, you get the facilitation at the collinear case, but we do think that, you know, the story is a bit richer than that. So you do get cells that, for example, prefer this kind of configuration as opposed to that kind of configuration, even if the population prefers that. I want to get that. Go show you a little bit more about that in a sec.
That's monkey.
That's monkey. That's right. But a lot of these interactions.
Is the
inhibition. That's right. Now, so we gradually want to kind of build up the complexity of the stimulus. We think that this brightness induction effect, first of all, is something that is cortically mediated, partly because it's orientation dependent, and also it doesn't depend on the total amount of light that is present in the contextual stimulus, because there are other sort of configurations that can, where you even increase the light further, where you can actually block the effect. And also we think that it has to do with this idea of continuity of lines, of the sort of contour integration, because if you do something to block the continuity between these two lines, such as use a T-junction, a crossbar between them, you can make the facilitation go away. And then you can take this even further and to see how this might relate to the phenomenon of contour saliency. And what we do is we have a set of stimuli where we have this pattern of randomly oriented and positioned lines surrounding the receptive field. The blue box in the center represents the minimum response field of the cell. So you always have this line element within the receptive field at the optimum orientation of that cell. And then you gradually shift line elements into alignment with the receptive field, gradually forming a more extended contour that goes for quite some distance beyond the receptive field. And what you see is, if we just focus on the one on the left, so a line within the receptive field gives a certain response, and as you put lines outside the receptive field, you get this facilitation. But in this example, if you embed that line within the receptive field within this complex background of randomly oriented line elements, the response is greatly inhibited, because it's known that there are these extended inhibitory flanks outside the receptive field. But as you shift line elements into alignment with the receptive field, you gradually remove that inhibition and in fact get a further facilitation in the response beyond what you got from the line element within the receptive field. So this makes a number of points. One is that the responses of neurons are as dependent on the global characteristics of contours extending well beyond the receptive field as they are on the attributes of the stimuli that are centered within the receptive field. And another thing.
So you're basically sort of redefining the receptive field.
Exactly.
It only gives you spikes, and then there's a point that would encompass the entire organization itself.
Just so. That's the good summary.
Is it flashing?
These are flashed, yes.
What's the difference between the left and right?
These are just two examples.
And is there a statistical difference between 5 and 3? If you have one above one below and
five is just the. That's just the one where you have nothing outside. Just have the complex pattern outside the receptive field with no alignment. One on the left you're looking at. This one, and this one. This is three, right?
Yeah, that one.
And this
right.
is. Oh, and this one.
Yeah.
Ah. I don't know in this case. We do get, frequently get progressive and significant facilitation as you add lines, but it does tail off. So we don't generally get too much more beyond having five lines outside the receptive field. I can't tell you in this instance.
So Charles, there were sort of measurements of the receptive field of cells using noise, which is gap correlation. Like Larry Palmer,
right?
Have done this, and you get a map. Just let's worry about the spatial part of that. But the map for areas that are excitatory and areas that are inhibitory, and it
yes.
sort of wiggles and nods. So, but the statement was is that more than less. Linear response theory held for describing these cells in visual cortex.
Okay.
So how does this data make the same? Can you also make just a transfer function, a linear transfer function, more or less recover?
No. So this clearly indicates that the responses of neurons, at least complex cells in the superficial layers of the cortex, are highly nonlinear. And there's no way that you can account for the responses to a complex stimulus from the responses to a simple stimulus placed in different parts of the receptive, the visual field. But one thing that clearly distinguishes this from, well, let me just sort of address the Larry Palmer thing. He was recording from simple cells in layer 4 of the cat's visual cortex. And it seems quite clear that the closer you are to the thalamic input or to the retina, the more reliable these kinds of back correlation experiments are. But as you get farther away, it's much more difficult to pick out these nonlinearities. So even Clay Reed, who tried to do this in the monkey, found that that you had to use much more organized stimuli as your basis stimulus. So even when he was trying to do look at the responses of cells in the blobs and the superficial layers, these are cells that have circularly symmetrical center surround receptive fields, he had to use annuli rather than spots because the back correlation just didn't give you anything, didn't show you the distribution of the receptive field map. Right. So I suspect that the sort of layer 4 simple cells are likely to be more linear than superficial layer complex cells. But go ahead, why don't you...
But you don't think it's just a matter of having a linear response that it then goes through a threshold, or a threshold linear cell that is just sort of serial processing. That it's true, you don't excite the cell when you have a bar out in the flank because the cell hasn't reached threshold potential. But if you were to put on a stimulus in the center or put on snow, maybe like Larry did in the opening eye, binocular cells, that you may discover that the cells can be described by a linear response followed by some threshold or threshold linear model.
I suspect that thresholding is actually a nonlinearity, but that has gone a long way to explaining some of the nonlinearities that people observe. So I think David Furster and Ken have sort of shown a lot about what that can do for you in terms of orientation selectivity. But we also know that there are other sorts of nonlinearities, like these voltage-dependent sodium conductances. So that is something that that we think may account better for these facilitatory influences we get from outside the receptive field. So that's not a thresholding, but it's just that the actual synaptic potential you get from the horizontally evoked input is much larger when the cell is depolarized from some other source.
Can I comment on the influence of these techniques in auditory synaptic sensory systems, which a little later, but then took over. Every lab in the world was describing STRFs in auditory systems.
Yes, I see. Yeah.
Transfer function. It's a reverse correlation.
Yeah.
I was at a meeting in July, which both camps fought out for a week. And so many examples of nonlinearity were shown. Hysteresis effects, all sorts of nonlinearities. But in the end, the conclusion was that all the camps are useless. Tribal warfare, in fact. It was an intense battle that
it didn't. Just to face
some of them, particularly those that had poor techniques, by in visual terms, you'd want this stimulus to be white, so you cover more bases. And many of the stimuli used in the synaptic system can't be white because it's too complex a space to be involved in. So, as a physiologist reporting qualitatively before this influence, I was really surprised by this approach. It almost seemed we knew too many nonlinearities to begin with. Simply was going to get really useful. But I had you felt.
Yeah, no, I think that you sort of quickly run out of steam, particularly when you're trying to account for kind of higher order interactions.
Charles?
Yeah.
Is there time.
Okay, good. Give me 5 minutes, and sure. then we'll just take a break. So it seems that even in primary visual cortex, cells are doing a much more global integration than the sort of original Hubel Weasel's description of their properties would have suggested. but it's probably useful to understand a little bit more about the nuances of the receptive field and what's classical and what's non-classical. And because there are various ways of teasing out these rather more extended influences, some of which use measures that by any body's definition people would call classical measure. So I wanted to distinguish the kind of receptive field measure that you get by what is called a minimum response field technique. That's where you take a single line element, a short line element, and you place it in different positions along the orientation axis, for example, and you get a profile of the receptive field versus what you get from another technique that has been used for many years, length of tuning. So you just use the stimulus and you increase the length of the stimulus and see how the response increases as you increase the length and maybe then drops off because cells are end inhibited. They have the inhibitory flanks on either side. Well, a lot of the original work would have indicated that the two techniques sort of give you more or less equivalent measures of the receptive field extent. But we found, this is also work that was done by Mitesh Kapadia, that the two techniques gave very different measures when you change the contrast of the stimulus, for one, but also when you change the foreground-background relationships in the stimulus. So here is the example from contrast. As you decrease the contrast along here, the minimum response field sort of gets perhaps somewhat smaller, although it stays within pretty much the same range. But the length tuning changes quite radically. So as you increase the length of the stimulus, at high contrast, it sort of peaks at a very short length, and then you get this long inhibitory flank. And so you get this sort of picture of the receptive field. But as you decrease the contrast, you get to a point where the end inhibition gets progressively weaker, and the length summation is progressive over much longer distances. And so the actual receptive field length, but measured by this technique, length tuning, is much longer at low contrast than at high contrast. And at the low contrast, there is about a six-fold difference between the length measured here, between this point, and the length measured with the minimum response field technique. These are all done on the fixation plane, so there's no ground in the stimulus. It's just a single bar. So one distinction that I'd like to make between the sort of classical and non-classical description of the receptive fields is that there is a difference between what you get with a simple stimulus and a complex stimulus consisting of many oriented line elements in different positions around the visual field. But also one should keep in mind that even with the simple stimulus, you can get very different results depending on other characteristics, contrast being one. And then another thing that we did was to see what would happen even with a high contrast stimulus placed when the stimulus is placed within this complex surround. And so you can see that the length tuning for this cell, even at high contrast, can be induced to be progressive over longer lengths by having this complex background, whereas this is the same contrast with no background, and here the response peaks at this point. And they all tend to converge at the same response level at the long lengths. But at least in terms of the length tuning of the cell, this tends to show this summation occurring over longer distances or when you have this sort of more complex stimulus. So, let's see. I guess if people need a break, maybe we can do that now. So what I want to do now is to talk about contextual interactions in two and then three dimensions. And then with the contextual interactions as a background, then get to show about how these contextual interactions can be modified by experience and by top-down influences of attention. now, so far we've talked about the contextual influences operating along the orientation axis, but we were also interested in seeing how they might operate along, you know, in two dimensions and even in three dimensions, and so I'll sort of gradually build this up for you. To do the psychophysics of contextual interactions, we wanted to have some sort of probe that would allow us to map out the spatial interactions across two dimensions. And what Mitesh Kapadia came up with was to use the tilt illusion as a probe. Now, the tilt illusion, as is classically been used, generally has these kinds of global stimuli. So you have this center of a set of lines with a differently oriented set of lines surrounding it, or individual lines. And the percept is one of a repulsive interaction. That is, this central disc seems tilted in this direction relative to the outward disc. But what he found was that the direction of the interaction actually depends on the placement of these stimuli. So if you put the stimuli along the orientation axis, you get an attractive interaction. And if you put them along the orthogonal axis, you get the repulsive interaction. If you have stimuli all around, then the repulsion dominates, but you can actually get different directions of interaction depending on the placement of the stimuli. So what he did was to map out this interaction by putting two bars in different positions around a central target bar. And so this gives you this kind of two-dimensional map. And what he finds is that he gets attractive interactions along the orientation axis, and repulsion along the orthogonal axis, and that is embedded on a sort of general sea of repulsion. So there's a real structure to this.
This is psychophysics.
This is psychophysics. And this is physiology. So it actually seems to...
The psychophysics is amazing.
Don't read too much into the symmetry, because he just did half the field and then reflected it. But go ahead. Okay. Did he do a quarter? Well, in some he did a quarter, and some he did a half. This is probably.
It kind of showed us this, you know, the wave functions and frozen. Right, never mind.
Right. Well, these are p orbitals, right? And if you use a different measure when you do the physiology of facilitation or inhibition, you get a very similar distribution. So you get facilitation along the orientation axis and the inhibition along the orthogonal axis. And this is a measure of the interactions. That is, the difference between what you get with this set of stimuli minus what you get with the individual stimuli, the line or the surrounding stimuli. So this is this. Well, you might ask, what, you know, exactly how they're related. So certainly, at one level, there seems to be a similar kind of distribution of opposing effects, whatever they are, around the receptive field as they are perceptually. Now, and we think that one can account for these differential interactions by the relative balance between facilitation and inhibition in this sort of circuit. So, as I mentioned to you before, you get both direct excitation and bisynaptic inhibition with these long-range connections. But just by tweaking the strength of one or other arm of the loop, you can make one become more facilitatory or more inhibitory. And you can get both kinds of interactions from the horizontal connections. Right? In terms of whether you can account for the shift, the tilt illusion by facilitation inhibition, we've actually done some experiments much earlier on this, and we relate it by this sort of model, where you can say this is just a simple vector model where you say that your perceived orientation depends on a contribution from cells that are line labels for different orientations. So if you stimulate with a line of this orientation, you activate this cell more strongly, these cells more weakly, and these cells not at all. and each of them contributes to varying degrees, depending on their strength of firing, to the readout, and you just sum their vectors, which are represented by their line labels, and that gives you the same orientation in. But if you do something to perturb the orientation of these units, such as to this is with isoorientation inhibition, so this is the orientation of the surrounding stimuli, and the idea here is that you suppress all units that have that orientation, then that will cause a weakening in the signal from this channel and a shift in the orientation away from the orientation of those units or of the surround. Whereas if you have isoorientation facilitation, that'll sort of strengthen this vector, and you'll get a shift towards the surround. So that's how you can, in principle, account for the tilt illusion in terms of isoorientation, facilitation, and inhibition. Now, when we actually did the experiment on a number of units, we actually saw a number of different kinds of effects. We did see these sort of isoorientation, inhibition, and facilitation effects. We also saw shifts in the preferred orientation of cells, and so we haven't yet done this for a sufficient number of cells and sort of in the monkey to be able to see what the dominant influence is on the tuning of cells. But at least
the model is highly non-trivial. What you did is you scale the tuning curve, right? By a much bigger factor, one dimensional. So how can this be realized? I mean, this model is highly non-trivial.
Yeah, no, but this is all this says is that there's a facilitation in the response of these cells, which we see. I mean, that's what the observation is in this 2D receptive field map.
But wasn't the observation that when you put these flaggers here, you increase the response to the vertical
drive,
right?
This is increasing the response two cells that have the orientation of the flankers.
So that's what the previous map showed us?
Yeah. This map shows you isoorientation interactions. I'm going to get, in a second I'm going to talk about interactions between different orientations. But this is isoorientation interactions.
Did you do it through the vertical?
No, I mean, this could be any orientation. It's just that Yeah, but this no. This just, I mean, this is just how we represent the maps.
Yeah,
we just rotate the map too.
But this always represents the isoorientation.
That's right. That's the isoorientation, but yeah, within this kind of configuration.
Well, it's a bit surprising because if you think about that, there are huge for this kind of thing, right? For a small tilt of one bar versus another, you would think that you would like to have pulsion to facilitate.
Well, the
this
attractive tilt peaks at 5 degree difference, and then as you change the orientation difference to 20 degrees, it goes back to repulsion.
Yeah, but hyperacuity is much smaller.
What are you talking about hyperacuity?
Hyperacuity, but not for the shift. You know, there are many hyperacuity.
That's not a hyperacuity.
Well, okay, maybe so. But yeah, how would you call it? There is also you can see small tilts of one bar versus another.
Yeah, that's the argument for why the tilt illusion is present, or why you get these repulsive effects.
Right,
but the fact is that it's not always repulsive. In some instances, it's an assimilation, so you don't actually see an orientation difference. It sort of pulls the central line towards you.
But the fact is that you do see small tubes better than
you have the second. No, the fact is, and that's what this shows. At this 5 degree orientation and in this configuration, you see it less.
Okay, so now this we did this experiment in Dolce Gilbert, and we see very strong.
At what orientation?
At oblique.
No.
We measured the minimal orientation we see.
Yeah. So we're saying that it'll be different for this configuration than for this configuration. No, I know, that's what I'm saying. It'll be different for this configuration than for this configuration. In this configuration, there's an assimilation,
And so the simulation means that you should see it should count you in defending the cup.
Right.
And we found that this helps you very strongly.
But you say you don't have the comparison. The relevant comparison is between this and this.
No, we did the comparison.
I know what you did, but I'm saying.
Okay.
I think the point is. So.
I'm confused here because this one.
What?
This one is not isolated, right? The flankers are 5 degrees off, and
that's right.
Saying, are you repulsed or attracted to the flanker?
That's right.
And the next one is showing us
isolation
enhancement or suppression.
Right. That's right. And so this model tries to relate the two by isoorientation interaction effects, which can produce the repulsion when you have lines of different orientation because of what it does to the...
Okay, so this means that for parallel things, you see smaller fields.
Some paradigm a memory component or an adaptation to a stimulus and another stimulus.
Yes, that's right. That's known as a tilt after effect.
Yeah.
And we didn't do that. We sort of did...
You need to adapt one of the channels here.
Excuse me?
You need to adapt one of the channels to account for that.
That's right. So it has to be a long-term effect. Which may work. Well, I don't want to get too much into it because we haven't done it consistently, but we have seen these sort of adaptation effects where if you sort of have this surrounding stimuli and then measure the orientation tuning of the curve, it sort of shifts, but then there's some hysteresis, so it doesn't shift back right away.
Show tuning curves, right?
Here?
Oh, these. Now, one was this distorted tuning curve. But what you actually measure is just the value at the dash line, right?
That's right.
So, could we be able to measure the whole tuning curve and how it changes depending on. It's not the line, right? I just wonder how this compares to the experiment. The distorted tuning curve for this.
Yeah, so this is just a suppression of the response, right?
My question is, this looks like just scaling it up or down by a factor.
That's right.
Is this what you mentioned?
We have seen that. That is actually, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the only effect that we see, so that's why this
would
is...
It would also add something, right? A completely different effect.
You mean facilitate? Or you mean like this? Or...
No, by adding something, it would also respond to some orientation productivity effect.
I see. So you're changing the bandwidth. Yeah, that's we have seen that. So that's the trouble. With the initial... These are experiments we did over a decade ago. We were looking at the changes in the orientation tuning profile by contextual stimuli, and we saw a lot of effects. And since it wasn't clear which one was the dominant effect to explain these kind of tilt illusions, so we did see a broadening and narrowing of tuning curves. We saw this sort of facilitation and inhibition. But we also saw shifts in the optimum orientation by, say, 15 degrees. But some of the shifts were attractive and some were repulsive. So, I would like to redo this only now where you sort of constrain the stimuli to different positions around, the surround stimuli to different positions around the receptive field. So there are other, and we had other models where we sort of showed how you could get the tilt by broadening the orientation tuning curves, for example, that will also give it to you. So, how this relates to these phenomena of intermediate level vision, our thinking is that these facilitatory effects that you see along the orientation axis can play a role in contour saliency or contour integration in this sort of manner. And the isoorientation inhibition that you see can sort of signal the presence of texture boundaries. So it's good for surface segmentation, where you sort of inhibit the signal from fields of similar texture and only bring out the signal where there's a texture discontinuity. Now, these effects... Oh, and there was another question that I wanted to relate this to that somebody brought up. Oh, yeah, about the anisotropy of the connection. So there is some evidence from the tree shrew. From the tree shrew that these connections are highly anisotropic, and that the it sort of seems to map onto the kind of facilitation that we see, where the horizontal connections go along the same axis as the orientation of the source cell. So it's not only connecting like to like, but along that same axis. But both in the cat and the macaque monkey, you don't get the same degree of anisotropy. Now, there might be some, but it certainly by no means matches the distribution of facilitation that you get by some sort of relative change in the balance of the inhibitory and excitatory connections between the cells. Now, interestingly, in the tree shrew, there also seems to be much more sort of facilitation, that is the length summation. So in fact, it almost seems to match the extent of the receptor fields of the cells, and there's some suggestion that you have less inhibition for the tree shrew. Now, it's not clear to me why that would be, you know, what there is in the ethology of the tree shrew's visual experience that means that it doesn't need to do the inhibition. I mean, it certainly needs to do surface segmentation, you would think. But there is a clear difference between the species, both in terms of the amount of inhibition you see around the receptive field and also the anisotropy of these connections.
Creatures spend their first few months inside a hollow dark log.
So they don't need to see it all.
They have very little visual experience in their first few months.
Right.
I mean, it also could be that, you know, this different function is delegated to different visual areas, because the folks that don't have exactly the same number of cortical areas as monkeys.
Right.
Then their areas of the feet would do the job of monkey V1 and V2.
Yeah. So that'd be interesting to look at some other areas in the tree shrew to see how that works. Now, if you sort of go even farther beyond the realm of isoorientation interactions, you see a lot of interesting phenomena that give very different patterns of facilitation. This is an example of a cell that we looked at, looking at interactions between orthogonal stimuli. And here we got this very curious distribution of facilitation that went along 45 degree axes relative to the receptive field, as opposed to the isoorientation axis. And that at first seemed sort of a curiosity that we didn't really, we found difficult to explain. But at the same time, we were doing this study, and this is work that we did with Marcelo Magnasco and Guillermo Cecchi and Mario Sigmund. And the purpose of the study was to see if there was any sort of consonance between the interactions between contours present in the natural world and what we were seeing at the level of receptive fields in V1. And so what they did was they took a library of images, and this is just something they got off the web, but we've been sort of taking some other images ourselves. And within these images, they did a local measurement of the dominant orientation at every pixel. And then they did a correlation of when you saw, say, a line of a particular orientation somewhere in the image, where else did you see lines of that same orientation, and similar for other different relative orientations. And so what they found was that extending over very large areas of visual space, isoorientation interactions tend to go along the same axis of orientation. So this configuration is much more common than that one. And interestingly, for orthogonal orientations, they found this sort of 45 degree relationship, where this kind of configuration was much more common than this configuration.
How much does it take for you?
I would have to sort of look back to remind myself. This whole thing here.
Mm-hmm.
I think this.
Well, there's a scale.
It's 10 pixels, but I'm trying to remember relative to the whole image.
There was a scale behind the whole image.
Yeah. Oh yeah. This is the size of the individual. No, this is the size of the sort of individual window that they used to take the orientation, but.
You have this 100 pixel thing.
And oh yeah, there's the okay. Good.
About
yeah.
The size of the collection.
Yeah. And
so there's essentially no correlation beyond 100 pixels. No, that's the power picture. How large is that in the picture?
I think that's a bit more than 100 pixels, but anyway, that's 100 pixels.
Isn't there some trick with the normalization? I mean, that when you do this correlation, you can normalize by other orientations of the same location, or you can normalize by other locations of the same location.
No, I don't think they did that.
Can you explain if this is the cross-correlation between those two bars where you're shifting, where it's the relative position?
That's right. So this position in the map would be this sort of relative position. This position in the map would be this relative position, and so on. So
you're plotting out, given the one bar here, what's the probability of finding another bar of a fixed orientation?
All around. Exactly. Exactly. And so you get these kinds of probability distributions. I should say that these are normalized just for the peak. So at the peak, this is much more common than this. But they all reflect a certain simple geometric principle, which is one of collinearity or co-circularity. So where you see this sort of, if you imagine that you have a reference line that is embedded within a circle or within a series of circles of different radius of curvature, where you see orthogonal orientations describes this 45 degree axis. And actually, I may not have. And there's a very. Let's see what's next. And there's a very good fit between the prediction of co-circularity and what they actually found in the geometry of natural seams. So this indicates, I mean, why natural seams are built this way, one can sort of speculate. But this indicates that the kind of rule of good continuation that the Gestalt psychologists had talked about sort of 80 years ago can be accounted for mathematically in terms of this simple geometric principle. So this idea of good continuation is that they sort of talked about is essentially maps onto this idea of co-circularity. So straight lines tend to continue straight for long distances. Curved lines tend to maintain their curvature along the same radius of curvature.
Which determines the curvature of the ideal circle?
That's right. So the probabilities are determined by just being on a circle. So for the 45 degree relationships, you have to imagine a series of circle of differing radius of curvature, and the probability distribution follows that. Right, but it's not as if it's some other sort of strange curve shape where you would see the orthogonal line at some other position different than that would truly be characterized by being on a common circle.
Maybe
maybe using bars of different lengths, one would see a mixture.
But this is natural
series,
so they're
all
the
bars. Right.
Yeah, that's a good question. What happens if you vary the size of the
circle? I mean, there is nothing really special about circle other than simplicity. But the stratified relationship is really coming up that we are selecting circles out of ellipses, right? Otherwise, you are a different result.
That's right. Or other sort of odd shapes, or, you know.
But the statement that said what's special about the circle is that the curvature is the same everywhere.
Right. So there is a question whether what's special about the circle is just that you have one parameter less to describe it, or there is something in the statistics of numbers that would select circles. I think the formula is a bit more.
I don't quite understand the distinction that you're making, but you're suggesting that it has to do with the local filter that you used, or I mean, you're just assigning an orientation. You're not using
right, but there could be like a number of different things that make like this line 45 degrees, the line that 45 degrees, so that circles out of other shapes. One is the fact that really there is something about circles that they occur.
I think that's the suggestion.
That's one possible suggestion. But another thing is that among other objects which are kind of roundish, they are described by one parameter less. They have like simpler to describe. And
I'm not sure that would.
How does that account for the actual distribution that's in the metric?
Well, maybe because we can build like analyzers for natural streams that are as parsimonious as they can be.
It was just looking at every little location, assigning an orientation, and then saying what's the probability of having orientations at a certain angle and distance.
Right.
So I don't see how that.
So it could be that it's not something of natural streams, but it's something of how
you assign orientations at each point.
How we set up a neural system that. And we do that by using circles because that's the thing that
you can go. How would that explain the actual results, the correlation structure they see when they analyze natural things?
I mean, you have to make a distinction between the geometry of the scenes and any kind of relationship you draw to the receptive field properties, the filter characteristics of neurons.
I mean, they were showing us the geometry of natural scenes, and that it has certain correlations.
This does really not mean that if you have parallel contour elements, typically you have a small circle. In natural scenes, there are lots of parallel contour elements, but they are from the fields and from the.
But what it says is they're a lot less common.
What I think this means is that the correlations of the contour elements get lost if you go beyond like the coherence length of curvature. So this statistics looks by its scale at a region where typically curvature is constant. So then a circle is a good model for that.
Well, it would pick up anything that would occur commonly. Mm-hmm. So, one of the things that the simple Laplacian operator that people had used, like in this analysis of 1 over F squared noise, that those interactions fall off over much shorter distances. But when you use the sort of oriented operator, they go over much longer distances. And I even have an image that shows it.
So what are your interests?
If contours curve around in all kinds of shapes, not circles in particular, but there is a typical length scale over which you cannot change the curvature much. So have essentially constant curvature on small length scales, then it local.
But the point is that they do go over long distances.
I would really see these correlations as function of visual angle. We tried it and couldn't get.
correlations beyond the degree, and many people have thought to have looked at contour statistics and say beyond the degree.
Oh, I think these go over quite a bit.
So yeah.
So what do you mean beyond the degree? I mean the angular scale of
the ones who have correlations of contour elements that are far than 1 degree apart.
I mean, if I come closer to the image, then it will be possible.
Charles?
So
what do you mean? Yeah, it's something out here, but in New York.
These are images
that are heavily selected images.
No, these were just a library of images that was convenient because they were digitized and available. And you know, we've been sort of taking our own images, but it's been taking a longer time to do that. But it's nothing special. This is just this was sort of an often referred to library of natural images.
But
there is a question about. I mean, these images included both sort of natural and man-made objects. And so the question is whether you would come up with a different statistics if you sort of had selected just exclusively pictures of buildings or pictures of faces or pictures of trees and stuff. So that's sort of a next level analysis that we'd like to make, if there is anything that is systematically different. But basically this suggests that there's sort of a fundamental default nature or character to the geometry of images, and that what the visual system is designed to do is the receptive field characteristics have embedded within them this correlation structure. So there's been a big discussion in the field about whether what the visual system does is to decorrelate versus to pick up correlations, and I suspect that it does both. I mean, the decorrelation hypothesis is that you're whitening the noise that's present. So you have this 1/f² noise, and if you wanted to sort of flatten out the distribution, that's what the kind of center surround.
So Yang Gao makes an argument that it sounds really cute because it's saying that the visual scene looks like 1/f, and the cells kind of take a derivative, so that looks like f, and looks like f times 1/f is just 1. It's stupid as you can get. And what you're forgetting about is the fact that the synapse has a certain noise characteristic. If you want to sort of match the inverse right noise characteristic, it's kind of like the commutative building that it's for.
So you think it just comes. This was basically the school of thought that sort of started from Crick, Ullmann and Koch, the zero crossing theorem, and then the work that Attic and Redlich did. And so there's been this, and David Field, there's right. But
without putting any spectral constraints.
But this is a system where that constraint may be the most important. So you have a limited number of fibers in the optic nerve, and you want to carry the most detailed information about the visual image when you have a limited number of channels. When you get to the cortex, it's not clear that you're sort of channel limited in that way, but this sort of suggests something else. That so to the extent to which you may do this T correlation, that's fine. But here you have this situation where you want to do this process of linkage of contour elements within the image, and if anything could be linked with anything with equal probability, it would be very difficult ultimately to sort of figure out what constitutes a contour, what constitutes an object. But the suggestion from this is that you can make certain simplifying assumptions based on what the characteristic of the world is. So the characteristic, so the kinds of two-dimensional receptive field maps that we see have structures that reflect these correlations. And what they're doing is to say, well, at any given point in the visual image, there are a certain finite number of possibilities about what contour is linked with what. And so what the cells are doing are kind of selecting between these finite possibilities, rather than to try to solve some incredibly complex problem of that has an infinite number of solutions. And so the suggestion is that that's why you see this kind of, you know, like these that sort of 45 degree two-dimensional receptive field structure for orthogonal interactions.
I'm a bit bothered by this. So I wonder what would be the strength of this, not just the maximum interaction, where is the maximum interaction, but what is the absolute strength of the interaction? So it could be that just by symmetry between ellipses oriented like this and like this, the maximum would always be at 45 degrees, as I said.
Let's say again that...
That's because if you average among the ellipses that are oriented like this and like this, the maximum would always be at the circle, but maybe a very kind of weak maximum. I'm bothered by this idea that there are circles in natural things. I don't really think that.
Okay. Well, you do the analysis, and you tell me whether it impresses you as being weak and strong.
It's real. Generalization is really important. Most of the
hypothesis in order to be flat.
What
else has
to change the context? No, it's just, well, I mean, the idea that you get any structure at all, I mean, it could be that there, that if you have a line of any a given orientation, there may be sort of equal probability that lines of similar orientation could be anywhere. And this shows that, in fact, there's a very strong tendency for these things to occur in certain places.
What is the most likely?
So, the new image,
yes. Yeah. Oh well, no, there wasn't any. There wasn't any real image manipulation. And the reason why we chose those images is that there was a. I mean, they had to have certain kind of rawness to them. You know, if you take a JPEG image, it's going to get you completely screwed up. And so now we had to get a camera that gave you raw images and didn't do any of the production.
I'm not really listed, but how do you go from this to the sign of interaction? So you would, how can you predict from this that morpholinear excitation and
It doesn't tell you anything about these kinds of interactions, because these are sort of lower probability and. No, it sort of talks. It sort of relates more to the facilitatory interactions that we see. And there's also the question about. Yeah. Oops. This?
So do you know what the scale is here? That is, how high is the peak relative to that now?
We do. There's another image in there. See if I can find it.
Is there a symmetry to the connection? Just talk with that. This is your point that I was on. It's multiple extensions. The first term is decent. So the only question is, what's the orientation?
And this, by the way, shows the scale of these interactions compared to. So this is.
Yeah. My question is whether this maximum is supposed to be 45.
So when you use this sort of oriented operator, you see the interactions going along this sort of extent over many more pixels than you do if you just use the center surround operator, which sort of drops off over much shorter distances. I don't remember between the blue and the red what that was.
It's a vegetable.
Just get him in
the
photograph.
Yeah,
this measure of what's that?
No, with all seriousness. If it's just artifact, go to
Bali. Go to what?
Go to Bali. You're in New York City, on the wall bank.
Uh huh.
And you drop down vegetables.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what we're doing. We're taking pictures of everything we can. But
I think what Alessandro is saying is a very valid point, and that is that if you took contours, closed contours, and you randomly drew them, and then you started to look at the correlations of different distances, you probably would see a strong peak at 45 degrees only because every potato this way, you get another potato this way. And then if you add them all up together, you probably...
I'm not sure that that's true. I mean, I'm not entirely sure I understand the configuration that you're looking at, but...
Because every correlation you would see, let's say, 52 degrees, would also find...
What do you mean by 45 degrees? You mean closer to the earth? If you're looking at your final center...
Let's say looking at the bottom, you'd find it.
They'll find them at all angles, but you can think of them.
No, but that's not what has been done here. So there are two different questions that you can ask. One is, your orientation is horizontal here, then what is the most probable orientation of a given point in space?
Right.
And that's what you think is being answered, but that's not what is being answered in that work. In that work, the question was, if the orientation is here is like this, where in space are you most likely to find this orientation?
Right.
And then the answer is like shown here.
Exactly,
but that is not exactly the same as the first question that was asked.
But you're looking for lines like this, and you look all of the steps, and he finds that you go this direction.
That's right.
So the question is, if I took vegetables and threw them on the floor to plot for all the configurations, but I also find maximum.
Yes, you would.
And I think you would, right?
Yeah.
For multiple expansions.
No, why would you? Why wouldn't you see them anywhere?
No, but the maximum, you'd still get somewhere the maximum probability.
Yeah, but why would they...
That's what Alessandro was asking as well. There's an amplitude between the maximum and the minimum. See, the reason why you would expect an orientation is because these things are closed objects, so that away from here, those things are different. But then I see your intuition. Your intuition is saying that I'm going to average out, it's going to be zero. It's flat every time. But I don't think so. I think that there would be some preferred multiple.
Yeah, I don't see that.
But that's something we could try, right?
Yeah.
So it depends on what your ensemble is, right? I mean, you can define your ensemble differently.
So we could do an ensemble of different sized potatoes. Randomly oriented and try it.
So what is a potato size of tuber as well?
To me, the potato is like a more classic object in nature.
No, there's oranges too.
No.
We can do
basketball and then hit it. Anyway, so the question is where are these sorts of interactions going to be coming from? Because we've already sort of described the specificity of the long-range connections, which are sort of iso-orientation in nature. So somehow we have to be able to get interactions between orthogonal orientations and disparate positions in the visual space. And where we think that may be coming from is based on a relationship between the orientation maps and the map of visual space that Henri de Dos found. And what he found was that these two are not independent, and in fact the map of visual space as you go across the cortical surface is not uniform. There's not sort of a uniform shift in position, but that it sort of starts and stops. And the starts and stops are related to the fractures in the orientation map, so that if you record from an area of relatively uniform orientation, such as that green area, all the receptive fields, in addition to having very similar orientation preference, have identical position receptive fields. And then if so that's even if you sort of have this amount of separation between the cells. But if you have this a similar separation, but you're going to a region of orthogonal orientation, such as between one and sites 1 and 2, there's a sudden jump in the receptive field position, so that these are non-overlapping. And so along with the change in orthogonal change in orientation preference, there's a big shift in receptive field position. And it's sort of interesting because a lot of the work that had been done on visuotopic order sort of talked about the presence of a good deal of scatter in receptive field position at any given location in the visual cortex. But the trouble is that it's very difficult to get a reliable measure of receptive field position, because the eyes are constantly moving. And you think that you've got control over eye position if you paralyze the animal. You don't. Even under paralysis, there can be a good deal of muscle movement. And so Anuruddha had to go to a lot of heroic measures to keep the eye position stable in order to be able to reliably measure receptive field position. And even then, we had to have a reference electrode, because even when we glued the eye to a ring, there was some distortion in the orbit, and you could get small changes in eye position. So we not only paralyzed the animal and glued the eye, but also had a reference electrode so that all receptive field maps could be compared relative to this reference. And under those circumstances, you find that there's remarkable constancy in the position of receptive fields. But at any rate, what this shows is that there is a capacity through short-range connections, and this sort of relates to the question about, you know, within a millimeter, do you also contact orientation columns of orthogonal orientation preference? You can, by relatively short-range connections, get connections between orthogonal orientation columns that also link disparate positions in visual space.
Charles, what's the discovery look like? What's the branch point?
The fracture?
Yeah.
They look different in different positions. They're not just, you know, there's the kind of classical view that Tobias Bonhoeffer and Amir Grinvold said, with their pinwheels around the center. But actually, you also frequently see things like this that are sort of more of an elongated discontinuity.
No, not the orientation. This is a single example, right? Like from 1 to 2 and it's a break.
Yeah.
Can I impose a grid on the world?
Yes, we did that. Let's see if it's in this. Let's see if I had it. I have to search.
How can people make orientation grids if they don't make traditional grids? Like move a dot to make a reflectance map, move a dot to make a reflectance map.
I don't think it's
in here. You don't have enough resolution. And discontinuity.
I don't think I have it here.
Is it too small? You don't have a response.
To resume the presentation, I have to go back and page through all the slides. That's why.
You can actually start with a little presentation with PowerPoint. If you select the slide activation and then
move
the dot and then use the symbol and then you go to the slide.
Okay. Well, in any case, I think I don't see it in here. You have to go back to the paper.
Yeah.
Okay, so finally, I can describe. How much time? Okay, if people want to see. I don't want to lose the sort of the final part, which is actually to go beyond these contextual interactions to show how they're modulated by experience, and
it's
new now.
It's new.
So,
you want to finish that soon? What?
Don't stop.
I mean, I'm happy to keep going, but I don't.
How much more do you have?
Quite a bit.
An hour or more?
I can.
Well, when would be the next natural break point?
Like, we could break in 5 minutes, or for 10 minutes.
Do you want to do that?
We're taking more lunch if we have
I mean, I don't eat lunch, so, you know.
You don't eat lunch?
No. So. That's right. It's just food is a fiction. You don't really need food.
Even without food, we need time to consolidate.
We could break at a natural time soon, and we do it two, or we do it an hour.
Well, so
it never works. It's a failure. It's just a half hour round trip.
So 1:30
area.
1:30.
Why don't we see when we break? We say at an hour and a half, whatever time we break. That's the legitimate time scale.
Because I can only skip over parts of this because nothing's essential, but I did want to sort of show the stuff at the end.
Okay, so let's go to the next natural break point now.
Okay. All right. So
you can address this question about the breaks, the special breaks.
We have this sort of grid map, distorted grid map, but I don't have it on the presentation.
Do you have an intuition? I mean, this is not my area, but I mean, you try to map three dimensions, orientation, space, over three dimensions. But do you have a sense of what breaks more?
What
I mean, the classical textbook view is that orientation keeps breaking and space is confused.
It's moving, yes.
But now you have data. This is not so. Do you have a sense for what the distortions are in space? Versus the distortions of orientation.
Sort of what kind of?
Yeah, they just need 1 degree orientations, off breaks. Are these 1 degree breaks in space? Is that typical?
Yeah, that's generally like the one receptive field diameter type. But there's actually sort of a quantitative comparison. You can actually say what the rate of movement is in space compared to the rate of change in orientation. And it was roughly 2 receptive field diameters for every full cycle of orientation.
Okay, and do all the breaks take place with these signals, all the spatial breaks? If you show the
yes.
spatial break across the signal.
Yes, they always take, because of that relationship. I mean, you can go across an area smoothly changing orientation and you'll see a smooth movement in visual space. You have a sudden change of orientation, you have a sudden movement in visual space.
I read your article was when it came out, and I thought that it was great that you had jumps across fractures, because I don't think it makes any data that you realize that how you're going on fingers. You actually do.
No, we did. Well, we didn't go around a pinwheel. We went. I mean, you get different kinds of arrangements of columns in different parts of the cortex, or you know, just sort of accidental differences. So, in some places, it's more kind of like the Hubble-Weasel ice cube model, where there's sort of parallel slabs, you know, just smoothly changing orientation. So we found an area like that and just did a sequence of electropenetrations there, and you get this smooth change in receptor field position.
I think you had a picture of the pinwheel.
Did we go? We went around
the first or the second paper. Not going around, but just two opposite points.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's the sort of thing that I showed, right?
No. There is another picture.
Well, you know, be careful. You aren't caught up into terminology. I mean, the difference between a fracture and a pinwheel is only whether the discontinuity is a circularly symmetrical thing or whether it's stretched out. And you see all kinds. So it's not like it's a distinct entity, a pinwheel versus a fracture. Okay, so the next bit of work was done with Jonathan Bacon and Ken Nakayama, and it relates to a number of perceptual phenomena that demonstrate that the this tendency to link contours in space depend on depth relationships. And in fact, you can have, I forgot to bring them with me, if you have things like the Knitzed triangle, it will look very different depending on where the positions of the corners of the triangle are. So if they are in the, as here, if they're kind of in the forward depth plane, then you see this completed triangle. But if they are in the sort of beyond the focal plane, it appears very different. That there's, it looks like you're looking at the corners of a triangle through three circular windows, and in two dimensions the stimulus is the same. It's just a question of where you put the corners in depth. And so this sort of relates to phenomena known as modal and amodal completion, where you're either sort of linking line elements that are in front or linking objects that are behind an occluder. And so to study that, we devise this kind of stimulus, where you can have this kind of a cross structure where the tabs on either side of the rectangle can be adjusted in space. And when they are in the near position, you have this very compelling illusion of a continuous bar going across the square. When they're both on the same depth plane, you just see the cross. And when they're behind, the illusory contour switch to here. And so what we did is to have a receptive field as represented by this dotted red line. And so the idea is that we are now just changing global disparity cues. So this is, so the stimulus within the receptive field is identical under all circumstances. It's just a uniform gray square. And you're only changing the position and depth at a distant line element outside the receptive field. And so we get these very interesting phenomena where the response, say, you don't get much of a response to this cross-like pattern, but when you have the near stimulus, you get a very brisk response. And when you get a far stimulus, you don't get any response. And then when you have this stimulus and then you bring the square forward, you also suppress the response. So these are the responses of cells in V2. And we didn't see anything like this in V1. That's right. That's right. We're altering the disparity. We actually have a stimulator where you show different images to the two eyes.
This was a cell that preferred
that orientation. That's right. And so it's clear that disparity plays an important role in the depth cues. And you remember, and this is sort of an issue of amodal completion, you remember that I showed you before that this facilitatory effect of a contour outside the receptive field can be blocked by the presence of an orthogonal line element going between them. Well, it turns out that blocking effect depends on the position and depth of the orthogonal contour. So you get the facilitation by the second line outside the receptive field, even when by itself it doesn't do anything. And when you put this orthogonal line across them, the facilitation goes away. But then when you bring that orthogonal line forward in depth, you get the facilitation back. So essentially, this is, you are then capable of completing the contour behind an occluder. And it also worked. There was another interesting phenomenon you see where disparity information in one part of the visual field influences the perceived depth in other parts of the visual field. And it's a phenomenon known as disparity capture. So here, all of these little line elements are sort of presented on the fixation plane. But when you bring the corners of the Knitzed triangle forward in depth, you see all of the line elements within the triangle coming forward in depth. And vice versa when you put them behind. So that's known as disparity capture. And we did a similar sort of experiment there where we had an array of lines. And the only disparity here, there's this correspondence problem where there are matching line elements at every position except at the ends of the array. So, and the ends of the array are presented outside of the receptive field. So within the receptive field, there is no disparity information. There's matching elements at every position. But outside the receptive field, there is disparity only at the end of the array. And there you can get disparity tuning just based on the relative position of the ends of the array, even if there's no change in disparity within the receptive field. So these are all sort of influences of global disparity. Within the disparity information that it may be somewhat distant from the core of the receptive field can influence the response of cells within the receptive field.
And where do you see those effects?
This is all in V2. In fact, these are all in the cognoscenti within the thick stripes of V2, where you see strong disparity selectivity. So therefore, these contextual influences can be very strong. There might be some differences in cortical area as to which contextual influences operate where. I mean, there's a whole range of other kinds of influences. For example, people talk about color constancy, which involves comparing the relative signal from colored patches in different parts of the visual field, and where even if the actual wavelength of light may change, the response of cells may reflect more the perceived color from a patch, even when you have very different conditions of illumination and the actual wavelength is changing. And this involves a comparison of relative reflectance across visual space. That's something that people have claimed is only present in area V4. So So I guess from this section, one can take that. So from the perspective of area V1, the cells are participating in a much more complex analysis of the visual field that involves integration over larger parts of visual space than one would think from their responses to simple visual stimuli, that they are capable of encoding information of much more complex stimulus features. And to a degree, this encoding of information maybe is reflected in the contextual influences, so that a lot of the stimuli that comprise these responses by themselves don't induce any kind of response, but they can strongly modulate the response of the cells, and that a lot of this has to do with intermediate level vision, the process of contour integration and surface segmentation. I'm now going to talk about. I'll break, but I will next talk about the way in which these influences can be modulated by experience. But just wanted to make a note that some of these influences have been shown to develop as a result of visual experience. So there's been a long-standing assumption the finding is that a property like orientation selectivity is present at birth and therefore doesn't require organized visual experience in order to develop. I think it was probably Ralph Linsker who first suggested that as a result of spontaneous activity in utero, you could get these sort of presumably highly organized receptive field properties like orientation selectivity to develop in an activity-dependent fashion. And there's been a lot of very interesting follow-up work on that. Ken has done a lot of work talking about how the property of orientation selectivity can evolve in that way. But even if these local and simple receptive field properties can develop in utero as a result of a spontaneous activity-dependent process, the possibility is that some of these higher-order properties might require visual experience. And certainly the suggestion, whatever you think of it, about the match between the response properties of these higher order response properties of neurons and the geometry of the natural world suggests that perhaps you may require visual experience in order to develop this sort of correlation structure of the receptive field, this two-dimensional higher order structure. And there is in fact some evidence to suggest that that's the case. So this is from developmental studies in children that shows that your ability to pick out one of these, let's see, I have a chalk here, your ability to see as salient one of these embedded contours within a complex background is something that is not innate. That is, you don't see it in newborns. And in fact, it continues to develop over the first 10 years of life. 10 years. And so the... I haven't. In fact, well, you know, it's sort of anti-intuitive because, you know, we're driving along and my 4-year-old and my 7-year-old will say, oh, look at that thing over there. And they're picking out something which, you know, I couldn't see. And I have to relive. I thought, oh, yeah, I see that there. So you think that they can actually... That's right. Well, you know, it seems as if their visual capacity is every bit as good, if not better, than mine. But this is a different thing. This is picking up global patterns. They're making this sort of broader relational structures. And this is something that the children are not as good as. And so it seems...
Is there any laminar specificity to where you see these global influences on responses? And also, what percentages of cells tend to show these sorts of effects or don't show these sorts of effects?
The kinds of effects that you see are very stimulus dependent. Mm-hmm. But let's just take the example of this contour facilitation, just the single line element surrounding facilitation. You know, over the initial range of contrast levels that we used to study, you know, there's a certain balance between facilitation and inhibition in the surround. So some cells are strongly end inhibited, and you don't see facilitation. If anything, you see inhibition. It also depends on the size of the gap between the stimuli, so there are a lot of subtleties in this. But roughly speaking, for the first pass, you'd see it in half the cells in the superficial layers. Now, since we've always been interested in trying to restrict the population of cells that we study because of the amount of variability you see across the layers, we've only really focused on the superficial cortical layers. And that's also where you see the horizontal connections. But also, you know, we're interested because those are the cells responsible for cortical-cortical connections, so we thought it was a good first stage to go through. You know, I don't know, I suspect I know what you'd find in deeper layers. For one thing, cells in the very, very deeper layers have much larger receptive fields. And so I think actually these horizontal influences become much more explicit in the sort of minimum response field maps, whereas they have the sort of funny, more kind of modulatory character in the superficial layers, where the minimum response field is much smaller.
And you don't know to what extent these effects might happen in layer 4.
I don't, right.
So, let's think that's my shot.